Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. It's me, Nick Shapley, here. And this week I want to talk a little bit about Prohibition. It's a really fascinating area of kind of social, political, and I guess criminal history that talked about to some extent, I think, in a couple of the specifications at GCSE level. But by and large, it doesn't get delved into as a phenomena in any greater depth normally than when we're looking at gangsters and Al Capone, which really is a kind of like a side effect of Prohibition. But the phenomenon of Prohibition itself is interesting because it tells an awful lot about late 19th century and early 20th century America and the development of social attitudes, particularly, obviously, as regards alcohol. But it's one of those things, a bit like when we were looking at the sort of permissive society in 60s Britain a few podcasts ago. The issue of prohibition is a kind of like a means, a prism through which we can view other attitudes and beliefs which were deep-seated within American society and culture at large. Now, the earliest references to the sins of alcohol can be found in America all the way back in the 17th century. And America wasn't alone in finding that alcohol was an increasingly a problematic substance. The developments of towns and cities in England and Scotland throughout the 17th and 18th centuries periodically give rise to moral panics over alcohol. You only need to look at some of Hogarth's inscriptions and engravings about the perils of gin in the 18th century to see that it was well understood that the tensions and pressures of what was developing into working class life in the towns and cities, combined with super cheap spirits and fortified alcohol, was creating all manner of social havoc that people were mindful of. And it's something that can be seen in Britain today with an epidemic of public alcoholism. So the phenomenon of alcoholism and kind of mass alcoholism was something that was in the public discourse in America from the 17th century onwards. But it's only in the 19th century when you get a series of religious revivals happening and you get the development, really, of an American middle class, that all sorts of new ideas come into the mix. Since the War of Independence and the creation of the United States, the question of tax had always been a very fraught one. Now, tax is often the best means of regulating alcohol price. However, throughout the period from the American Revolution all the way up to the dawn of the Civil War, the eve of the Civil War, beg your pardon, the question of the rights of federal government to levy taxes in particular states on particular commodities was an enormously fraught one. The South not only reserved their right to maintain the peculiar institution of slavery, but they also fiercely protected the right to levy their own taxes or not. Federal government was, in the eyes of many of those who had fought in the War of Independence, an unnecessary, necessary evil, but it must always be a limited one. Federal government existed really, in their eyes, as a kind of an umbrella, as a force of last resort, in case, of course, the French or the British or another European power decided they wanted to take back the Americas. As far as anything else went, federal government or central government was a nuisance and a threat to the liberties and the operation of trade. And particularly when it came to levying taxes on things like alcohol, there was potentially a mutinous talk. The first rebellion against alcohol taxation was the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania in 1791. So the question we've got on our hands, really, is how did a society which prides itself on a mistrust of government, you only need to look at grassroots American movements today to see that one in action, prides itself on a mistrust of government and a desire to keep government at arm's length, and a desire really to keep taxation at a minimum. How did this society produce prohibition and produce the government regulation and control of alcohol on a massive scale? Well, from the very beginnings of the 19th century all the way through up to the aftermath of the First World War, prohibition had been pioneered by temperance societies, which had developed very quickly firstly in the northeastern states of America, and then flourished as the Union developed and westwards across the rest of the country, particularly in the post-Civil War era. And the temperance movement was a largely Christian and largely Protestant movement in America throughout the 19th century. But it served a number of social purposes, particularly in the development of a middle class. Alcohol and alcoholism were seen as the curse of the working man. And whilst the new middle class men of America were not particularly encouraged to give up drink, the signifier, the sign of new female middle-class respectability, was abstinence. The consequences of alcoholism, both in the new towns and cities on both seaboards and in the interior, as the frontier was extended and eventually the interior wilderness of America was tamed, would have been abundantly clear to many of the new American middle classes, and working classes indeed as well. But it was the new American respectable that could look upon and frown and distinguish themselves from the debauched lifestyles they often saw in the new towns and cities, and particularly in what would later be referred to in Penny Dreadfuls as the Wild West. And there is a sense of mission, particularly after the end of slavery. There is a sense that the energies of good reforming Christian folk needed to be directed elsewhere. And the liberation of families, wives and children from the curse of drink was an ideal place to start. The organisation that most people are familiar with when they're talking about prohibition is the Anti-Saloon League. However, there'd been a long, long history throughout the 19th century of associations across America designed to work towards the end of public alcoholism. There's a shift away from the encouraging moderation in drinking through to outright abstinence. And the first main organisation is the American Temperance Society, which was created in 1826. And it wound up with 1.5 million members within a decade or so. And considering that the American population was considerably smaller at that point, it's no end of an achievement, really. This is in part due to the extent of religious activism within America and the extent to which, you know, America was seen as a new and, you know, fundamentally different society, which could hopefully have different rules, different traditions, and one which could potentially be free of certain social problems. The American Civil War, as previously mentioned, is hugely disruptive as it comes to the quest for prohibition, because both sides actually rely on the sale and taxation of alcohol in order to finance themselves. So it was particularly important not to ban it at this particular time. The post-Civil War era again presented opportunities for prohibition to establish itself, in large part because there is a need to channel and direct a lot of the emancipatory politics that had been galvanised in objection to the slave trade in a different way. And the Prohibition Party that was founded in 1869, and also the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, 1873, is full of the kinds of people who had originally seen slavery as the original sin in America. There is an awareness that women are the chief victims of alcoholism, in part because the men are almost exclusively the main or indeed the sole breadwinners in most families by the 1870s. And there is a well-established tradition of going via the saloon bar on the way home when one receives one's pay packet. And the progressives within the temperance movement, the left of the temperance movement, if you will, saw this as kind of part of the capitalist predation on the working man that was now an established feature of post-Civil War American life and the tensions therein. But the extent to which this was a really evangelical-driven policy was seen in states such as Kansas.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's deeply Christian in outlook, and the decision by Kansas in 1881 to try banning alcohol was fitting in a period of time where there was a proliferation of anti-alcohol activism in a run-up to the turn of the century. Evangelical groups would sing hymns outside saloon bars. And part of the reason for this, again, is to do with the development of America as an industrialized nation. The development of towns and cities meant the development of large urban populations and the creation of drinking establishments in order to bring them relief from what was probably the misery and the monotony of everyday working class life. And these rapid changes, these rapid social changes, bring about tensions and anxieties in parts of the population that see America changing and altering in ways that really they don't like very much. And alcohol becomes a kind of a byword. It becomes a sort of a cipher, if you will, for the sins of the modern world. During the Prohibition, the Progressive Era, you see the prominence of the Anti-Saloon League. The Anti-Saloon League is interesting because it kind of, its members are not simply interested in prohibition alone. They are interested in a whole range of things, women's suffrage and other progressive issues. They were led by Howard Hyde Russell, who was who'd had this profound evangelical conversion and had believed that really the law needed to perhaps be used to kind of interpret Christianity, and Christianity could be used to interpret the law. And obviously, you know, the American Constitution is a secular document, but there's always been this tension in the United States between the country as being largely secular, but with a great many of its citizens looking upon it as being Christian. Up until 1916, it's an issue that basically American presidents and candidates who were running for president really could do with ignoring. It was often seen as more trouble than it's worth. There were large factions in both Republican and Democrat parties who both opposed and supported the issue of prohibition. And so it was something that, particularly as the question of whether America would intervene in the war developed, was seen as increasingly an unnecessary encumbrance for presidents to have to entertain. War itself proves to be an interesting tool for the prohibition argument. Most of America's most successful brewers and distillers were German Americans. You need to look at brands such as Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch in order to appreciate that one. And the American prohibition lobby argued that really grain could be used in far more effective ways, such as making bread for the troops or for people on the home front, and that really what alcohol achieved, if nothing else, was loss of working days due to drunkenness. So sobriety and patriotism were quite neatly fused together. How far that had any effect on the drinker or those toiling in munitions factories is questionable, but that's not really the point. The effect that it had on public opinion in favour of prohibition seems to be quite significant. Prohibition, when it finally passed in December 1917 with the Volstead Act, is really a wartime measure. It is seen as something that is essential for America to win the war. And there's kind of echoes of this in Britain, in that the Defence of the Realm Act, passed by Lloyd George, enabled pub closing hours to be strictly enforced, and the number of British workers turning up to munitions factories, very, very dangerous places, still drunk or half cut rapidly decreases, and this is one of the chief reasons for it. So in that context, you can kind of understand why it is there was an interest in prohibition at an elite level. The question of how this libertarian nation that prides itself on small government winds up banning alcohol is really best answered by the fact that these are the exigencies required during a period of total war. And there is not only a libertarian small state tradition in America, but also a kind of Christian evangelical social reforming tradition equally as powerful and equally as significant. And when the interests of state power in marshalling the nation's resources to win the war meet with the ambitions of that kind of broad Christian social democratic reform lobby, then you get prohibition. And the libertarian trend in American thinking really is suppressed at that point. The problem is this, is that the war ends too soon. In December 1917, nobody really knows that the war is only going to go on for another 11 months. As far as anyone's concerned, in December 1917, the Germans are winning. And so the war ends and the Volstead Act is still there. And it's finally passed into law as the 18th Amendment in January 1920. And the Volstead Act requires a new tier of federal agents in order to enforce it. The Volstead Act prohibited the sale, manufacture, distribution or importation of alcohol in the United States. But it did allow people to make cider or wine at home if they chose to. Move into regulating what people did under their own roofs was seen as perhaps a step too far. Now, I want to talk about gangsters and that sort of thing in a different podcast. And the reason why is this, is that as a kind of a 20th century phenomenon, the gangster is very interesting. It's really only in the 20th century that gangsters like Al Capone or people like Pablo Escobar have wielded enormous kind of quasi-state power in some instances. And there's an interesting question as to why criminality has become this kind of globalised, multi-billion dollar phenomenon in the 20th and now 21st centuries, and in some instances can challenge state power. And I think it's more a question of what states have done, particularly with regard to prohibition, in order to create such characters. But so that is a separate discussion, and one I hope to do very shortly, because there's much more to be said about people like Al Capone than simply things like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. As we know, prohibition failed and was repealed in 1933 by Franklin Roosevelt in his first 100 days in office. And the legacy of prohibition really is one of bloodshed and violence and corruption and criminality. And it is part of, I suppose, this notion, not entirely a fair one, but this notion that people have of the kind of the corruption of America and the corruption of the American dream. One only needs to take a look at the kind of the instances of police officers on the take and judges who are in the pockets of various gangsters to see that there is something there. But the other thing we can see here is that obviously, prohibition is kind of like a forerunner to Richard Nixon's later and disastrous war on drugs. And it shows us that there is this kind of profound tension in American popular discourse between the rights of the individual and the role of the state. America is born of a revolt against taxation and is born of a revolt against government. And yet throughout the 20th century, government in America and Britain and most other first world countries has grown inexorably. And, you know, this is obviously part of the reason why there is this grassroots anger and resentment against federal government even today, though that's got an awful lot more to do with everything that's happened since 2008, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. So, yeah, it's just a very interesting theme, and I think one which I'll try to return to in later podcasts, this particular dichotomy. And I guess the way you can look at it, most objectively, is that, sure, there is this libertarian tradition in America and a dislike of big government, but much of what America has faced in the 20th century has required big government, has required a large militarized establishment in order for America to survive and continue functioning. Anyway, how do we get to from alcohol to nuclear weapons? God only knows. So that's all for today. Stay tuned to this podcast throughout the week. We've got some interesting announcements coming up. As I mentioned, got a new writer coming on board, Gina Bolter. She's a distinguished PhD and knows her stuff when it comes to China. So she'll be writing for us by Christmas time, a new ebook, loosely titled at the moment, After Mao, China from 1976 to sometime in the 1990s. I think we go up to about 1998. And we're looking at how China goes from becoming a virtually bankrupt state at the end of the Cultural Revolution to being the global power it is now, and what phenomenal changes and events have taken place in order to make that happen. We've got Julia Routledge returning with the genocidal century, looking at everything from the Armenian genocide all the way through to Rwanda and Bosnia. Cheery stuff, yes. And I'll be launching a new Explaining History title on China in the 20th century as well, sometime in the new year. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed today, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.